Okay. She put a hand to her temple. Her head throbbed. I'm not feeling very well. You haven't been eating, the boy said. You really need to get some sleep, too. Chris, it's Chris. What's wrong with you? Then the last half hour suddenly rushed back like pent-up water released from a dam. Embarrassment washed through in a hot flood that heated her skin. God, why did I do that? I've never told anyone about Carl. What's the matter with me? Yeah. Tears burned, and she bit her lip to stop a sob. Sorry. No problem. Just go to sleep. Kneeling, he pulled the bag up around her chin. Come on, you'll feel better in the morning. Her throat clenched. Chris! Hey, hey. He gave her shoulder an awkward pat. Don't cry. She gulped, felt the wet rolling down her cheeks. I'm scared. Hey, he said again, and then he stopped talking and just let her hang on while she hiccuped into his shirt. Sorry, she said finally. She dragged a hand over her swollen eyes. I'm sorry. It's okay. His hand cupped the back of her neck, and she let her head rest on his shoulder with a grateful sigh. We're all scared, he said. Not like me. You're not losing yourself. A weird thought that she didn't understand, but felt somehow was exactly right. She didn't want to let go of him, either. This was a bubble in time that was no more than a gasp, and as fragile as the thinnest, most perfect glass. I'm real. Right now, I'm here, and I'm me. She was afraid to move or speak, because then time would start up again, and the moment would be gone forever. Maybe her, too. For the first time in weeks, she was real. There was no other word that described how she felt, as if his arms not only held but defined her, gave her limits, kept her from falling apart, blasting to bits. She heard the steady thump of his heart, and his scent was indescribable. It's Chris. Pressing closer, she breathed him in. This is the smell of Chris, and he is real, and so is this, and so am I. Before she could stop herself, what a lie, she didn't want to stop, she was reaching up. Her trembling fingers feathered his neck, and then she heard him suck in a small, startled gasp. Lena, he said, please, 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 she whispered. Her body was shuddering, humming, warming. She brushed her lips over his skin, felt the hard throb of his pulse against her mouth, tasted the salt tang on her tongue. At her touch, he made a sound that was very far back, deep in his throat. She felt the sudden shock of it in his chest, the tremor rippling through his body like a bomb. She put a hand behind his neck, pulled his mouth to hers, and then they were kissing, and kept kissing, and his lips were warm and tasted of sweet oranges, and she focused on that, gave herself over to the feel of his mouth and his hands in her hair, the scorch of his fingers over her cheeks, her neck. She was tingling all over, greedy for his taste, moaning into his mouth, and then they were breathing in one another. And then he was saying her name, and she needed that almost more than breath. Yes, this is real, and I'm Lena. I am Lena. I'm... Lena, he pulled away, panting a little. No, I can't. I'm sorry, we shouldn't. This isn't me. But it is me. Yes, it is, she said. Her voice broke. Please don't. Please don't. Lena, he sounded out of breath. His hands tightened on her arms. This isn't right. It is, she heard the plea and didn't care. Chris, it doesn't have to mean anything more than what it is. It's not wrong. Lena, I can't. This isn't me, he said again. You love her. Her voice was used up and flat as paper, and she let her hands fall away. An enormous sense of defeat washed through like black water that might just sweep her out to sea or drown her. Same difference. I don't know, he said. I think so. I care about you, I do, but... Great, she gave a broken laugh. What every girl needs to hear. He was quiet for a moment. That's not fair.
Fair? Hey, newsflash, life isn't fair.
She heard the cruel cut in her voice, but she'd take anger over fear any day. Nothing's fair.
I know that, but I don't have to make things worse. That doesn't mean I shouldn't do what's right. So now I'm wrong? No, I'm saying I can't let Alex go just yet. If I'm going to, you know, be with you or anyone, it has to be you, not who I wish you were.
She couldn't believe this.
So what? Who cares? What about what I need? Don't I count for something?
Lena, you do,
but what? She spat. I'm not good enough? I'm not her? Have you stopped to think for 5 seconds how I feel? We are going to die out here, and you're worried about being faithful to a dead girl?
Lena. His voice had dropped to something low and dangerous. Don't.
Don't what? Don't say she's dead?
She hurled the word like a quick, hard crack of a whip.
Stop,
he said. There was a warning thrum to his tone. Lena, please.
Stop, Lena, please,
she mimicked, and then in her new and cruel voice,
she's dead, Chris, and if you want to think about something, think about this. She didn't love you. She used you, and then she ran away.
No, he said sharply,
she wasn't you, and I'm not Peter.
That hurt, but she was glad. Anything was better than this bone-deep fear.
Oh, you got that right, she said. Peter wasn't a scared little boy.
I'm not scared.
Oh, bullshit!
What's going on? Why are we fighting each other? Why are you doing this?
He asked. She didn't hear anger there, only a species of betrayal and wonderment, as if from a puppy that couldn't believe its owner had just kicked it.
What do you want from me?
I want you to make me real.
It was the first and most urgent thought.
I want nothing else to matter but right now, right here, on this goddamn floor in this awful place.
But what she said was,
I want to be safe.
As soon as the words left her mouth, she felt her fury dissipating, like a storm finally blowing itself out.
I want someone to tell me everything's going to be all right. I just...
A sob boiled into her throat.
I want the world to come back. I know it won't, but that doesn't mean...
She was hitching now, her shoulders shuddering.
That doesn't mean I don't want...
This time, when she felt his arms hug her to his chest, she did nothing but weep as if there would be no tomorrow. The chances there would be weren't very good anyway. And this time, nothing happened between them. But that was all right. That was just fine. Later. He wanted her to sleep. Things always look better in daylight. Oh, she doubted that. But she stretched out again and let him run the zipper. When he was done, he lingered, then laid a tentative hand on her shoulder.
I don't think it was him, Lena.
Him?
The boy from Oren?
He paused, maybe expecting her to say something. When she didn't, he prompted,
The one Greg brought back the morning Alex ran away?
Oh.
Her memories were gauzy and a little unreal, as if her life story were penned in an old book belonging to an extinct race from another planet.
Yes, I remember that.
She could tell that wasn't the answer he'd expected, but he continued.
The kid was 8, maybe 9, but your brother's 13, right?
She took so long to answer that he said, Lena?
Yes, that's right, she parroted back. He's 13.
That's what I thought. So I'm pretty sure it wasn't him, Lena. That means we might find him once we get back up toward Oren.
Okay, thanks, Chris.
She paused.
I'm sorry.
I know.
He gave her shoulder a gentle squeeze.
Me too. But it'll be okay, Lena. Everything will work itself out. Just get some sleep, okay?
Okay,
she said, a little surprised that the tears stayed put this time. As he rose, she added, Watch out for that tea.
What?
The tea, she pointed. The cup's by your left foot, next to the stool.
It is? There was a tiny snick, a spray of light.
The cup seemed to leap into being from the darkness.
Wow, thanks. I didn't see that.
No problem.
The bright yellow wink bouncing off the aluminum dazzled her eyes. Wincing, she rolled away and onto her side. A second later, she heard the click as Chris switched off the flashlight, followed by the shush of fabric, the slight squall of cold metal, a small sigh as he settled on his stool. Pulling the sleeping bag up to her chin, she stared into the darkness, first at the fuzzy blue ghost images of that aluminum cup, and then, as they dissipated, at the blocky silhouettes of lab tables and stools. Her gaze panned over gas spigots and chromed faucets, a glassy heap of broken beakers, a tumble of textbooks, a fan of torn pages from a lab book, the white face of a clock, its hands frozen at 21 minutes past 9, floated above the classroom door.
It's dark. I shouldn't be able to see this, but I do.
Her eyes burned, but she had no more tears.
Something's happening to me, and I don't know what, and I want it to stop. I just want things to be okay.
Yet she understood. Things would never be okay for her again. Whatever memories of a brother she'd possessed were gone. She knew, beyond the shadow of a doubt, that she must have a brother. The feeling was right.
But there was an emptiness inside,
the way there was when you chunked out the pit of an avocado, then scooped out all the soft innards, leaving only skin. Where there had been brother, now there was a blank, a kind of grayed-out mental afterimage with no face, no name, and not a flicker of memory. There was, instead, nothing. Nothing at all. Chapter 63. They came 3 hours before dawn. Chris hadn't woken Nathan to take a shift. After what had happened with Lena, he couldn't have slept anyway. Instead, he waited, alternately guilty and hollow-eyed with dread. He'd been so stupid. He did like Lena, just not that way. Did he? No. He had to protect her. Lena was sick and scared, as confused as he was. She wasn't thinking straight. No matter what she said, she was in love with Peter. He knew that. He couldn't shake Alex either, and didn't really want to, not just yet. Maybe hope was a terrible thing, but he held on to it anyway, despite what he'd said to Lena. So better to let this whole thing just go and concentrate on what he had to do next, one step at a time. He flicked a glance at the dim huddle beside his stool. Her breathing was even, sleeping. No more dreams either that he could tell. He returned his gaze to the snow. God, he hoped he wasn't right, but he just couldn't get past the idea that the changed boy had chosen to come out of hiding when he hadn't needed to, and he had gone for Lena. She was unraveling before his eyes. Before they'd kissed, stupid, 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 what was all that other stuff? It had sounded like a confession, yet when they were talking about her brother, he'd sensed her sudden uncertainty. Could be dehydration, maybe. Factor in no real sleep for days, and she was apt to be a touch confused. Wait. He raked his teeth over his chapped lower lip, considering, could she be dying? Oh, boy, he'd never thought about that. And if she was dying, they all were. He was just as exhausted, and Nathan was so much thinner. One stiff breeze, and he'd blow away. But she's sick to her stomach. He chewed off a strip of dead skin. Mornings are worst, so maybe... Movement on the snow. His gaze snagged on a dark slink. Even without the binoculars, he knew this was no wolf or coyote. He thought it was another boy, but one kid in a bulky parka looked pretty much the same as any other. He watched as the kid made a beeline for the bodies.
When Chris had come up with the idea of piling a goodly number of the dead out there on the snow, he'd simply told Nathan that he didn't want to risk any change trying to get into the school. That had enough truth that the old man hadn't questioned him. They thought 10 bodies ought to be enough for the night, but Nathan hadn't understood why Chris decided that 2 piles of bodies were better than 1. Now he held his breath as the dark, distant figure crept toward the first pile, which Chris had deliberately positioned closer to the woods. The shadowy figure lingered there for a long moment, and then kept going. Shit! His stomach iced, even as his brain argued, "Relax, you don't know what this means. It might not be anything more than he's checking them both out." He watched as the kid knelt over the second tumble of bodies. If more of them come and most head to the second pile, then it counts. Within minutes, more slinks did appear, the changed making their way across the open field, trickling over the snow like black ants homing in on spilled sugar. In total, he thought there were about 30. Only a few stayed with that first pile. Mostly, they clustered around the second. From what he could see through binoculars, these changed were pretty primitive, too. Baseball bats, golf clubs. He spotted one with a human femur. Another had an axe. No guns, though, and no throwing weapons. Knives would be tough to see in the bad light, but he thought they mainly used their teeth and their hands, gnawing flesh from joints, snapping and twisting off arms and legs the way you tore apart a turkey carcass at Thanksgiving. A wing here, a drumstick there. Skulls weren't like hips or knees, where you really had to work to get past thick, protective ligaments. A head was like a bowling ball balanced precariously atop a flimsy tower of vertebrae, held in place only by cords of thick shoulder muscle and sinew that were easily chewed through. He turned away from 2 kids playing tug-of-war with a tangle of intestines and looked down at Lena, now deeply asleep. "Please," he pleaded silently. "Please, Lena, keep sleeping. Don't wake up. You shouldn't see this." Mercifully, she didn't, but he saw plenty. The changed remained for what was left of that night, squabbling over the bodies, with no real cooperation that he could see. They were more like a flock of vultures. Not once did they look at the school. The worst moment was when one changed, he was almost positive it was a boy, reeled out something long and ropey from the pile of bodies, then looped his prize around his neck once, twice. Oh boy, Chris felt his stomach plummet. He squinted through the binoculars, but couldn't be sure. Might be guts. From a distance, you might almost think the kid was double-looping old-fashioned linked sausages. That would be weird. He'd never run into any change to actually wore body parts. But this kid might be doing nothing more complicated than carting off a mid-morning snack. Or it could be way more complicated. He wouldn't know until first light. A half hour before dawn, the changed oiled their way across the snow and into the darkling woods, vanishing like smoke. The night drained away. The moon had long since set, so he had to wait until a smear of thin morning light appeared. That second pile of corpses reminded him of the wreckage of a platter of chips and dip. Not a whole hell of a lot left, only leavings strewn over trammeled snow and ruined clothes. He looked hard, but didn't see it. That wasn't necessarily bad. He lowered the binoculars. His arms were lead pipes, and his eyes raw and gritty with fatigue. They had a long day ahead, and he should rest, but he had to be certain, which meant he had to go out there, alone, right now, before Lena and Nathan woke. Lena stirred only once as he slid from his stool. His heart scrambled into his throat, and he froze, the hackles along the back of his neck spiking with alarm. "No, no, no, not now, not now." After a moment, Lena sighed and let out a thick, incoherent mumble before falling still once more. It was the longest walk of his life, like marching to a scaffold. Outside, the air was deeply cold but dry, and his eyeballs seemed to shrivel. Breathing hurt. The hard crunch of his boots over icy snow was so loud that he winced. There was a pressure at his back, like someone watching, but every time he glanced back, only the school stared. With every step, he half expected hands to slip around his throat from behind or look up and find faces staring from the thick gloom of those woods. He had never felt more alone. What would he do with what he found or didn't find? What then? He could turn back. He was probably wrong. If he found nothing, that didn't prove anything. Even the changed got cold. But God, I hope I find it, he thought. I really, really do. But he didn't. 2 hours later, they led the horses from the gym. The sun was out, the snow glittered, diamond bright. Chris's eyes, already raw, began to water. Chris, Lena said. They hadn't said much to each other all morning, but now her eyes brushed over his with a look he couldn't decipher.
I'm sorry. I've looked everywhere, but I can't find it. Are you sure you don't know where my scarf is?
Slipping on his sunglasses, he hid his eyes and lied a second time. Nope, he said. Can't say I do. Chapter 64.
You should leave the dog, Melly said as Tom hefted Raleigh onto the swayback saddle.
Catching the dog's scent, Melly's horse, a mild Tobiano paint, nickered. Melly gave its pole a reassuring scratch.
An extra horse only slows us down.
I don't care, Tom said briefly. Turning aside, he began laboriously tying off the ropes, securing the bulky blue tarp with its sad bundle. His right hand complained, but he forced the muscles to obey. Dixie's wound had healed enough that he felt comfortable riding her, but he worried that Raleigh's body would upset her, so he'd settled on the king's horse. As he worked, a solitary crow perched on the flagpole let out a mournful cry that sounded like a person hurt bad. Or maybe it only sounded that way to him.
But the ground's frozen.
Weller was astride a big, very muscular blood bay.
You won't be able to bury him.
Then I'll burn him, or I'll pile rocks. That dog saved my life. He belonged to people I care about, and I am not leaving him here to rot.
Tom gave the last rope a grim tug. Even with the bandage and salve, his hand balled. Be a while until it healed.
What about the other animals?
Weller looked impatient.
I told you, I know a farm we can stop at on the way. 3 old guys, brothers. They'll care for them.
You sure they'll come if there are hunters on the way?
As sure as we can be, Melly said. Tom, we can only do our best.
But the animals didn't hurt anyone, Tom said stubbornly. They don't deserve to die for this.
And they won't, Weller said. But we have to leave now. You want to save that girl? You make the bombs and we blow that mine, and then we march in there and you get Alex out of that prison house.
He looked up at Weller.
It's never that simple. We have to get in without getting caught. I have to position the explosives just right, and they have to go off in the right order. I'm not even sure it can be done. A building with good concrete support columns would take at least a couple 100 pounds of explosives.
Look, we've been over this, too, Weller said.
All we've been over is that there's a mine you want me to help you blow up. What I want to know is why I should. How will blowing a mine full of Chuckies help Alex? How do you even know they're in the mine to begin with?
From the way Weller's whiskered jaw jutted, he could tell the old man was impatient.
Because I've seen them, Weller grated, and we've tracked groups. Way before all this happened, kids were always hanging around there, had their parties, explored the tunnels. It was a meeting place. I know my grandkids, especially Mandy.
Weller looked away, his mouth working, then hawked and spat.
Anyway, that's where a lot of changed.
Changed? Weller moved one shoulder in a half shrug.
It's the name rules given the little bastards. I prefer Chucky's, tell the truth. Changed makes it sound too much like a hand of God thing.
How many are there at any given time? Do they live there?
Weller's face folded in a thoughtful frown. No, it's like they rotate in and out in these packs and gangs, just like kids in a high school cafeteria. I'd say maybe 200, 250, sometimes more or less, depending.
That's a lot of kids.
Yet what Weller said echoed what Jed had mentioned on more than one occasion. Chucky's orbited the familiar. What better place to hang than where there'd been great parties and good times?
And they don't get cold?
It's like I said, Tom. Once you're deep enough, minds stay pretty warm, and they get hotter the further down you go. Hell, there were days I wasn't wearing but skivvies, boots, a hard hat, goggles, and gloves. There's a lot of space to spread out in that mine, too. Cut rock rooms for machine shops and storage areas. Places to rest, stretch out a while, even have lunch. There's this one big stope.
Stope?
Anything Tom knew about mines came from movies.
You mean a mine shaft?
Weller shook his head. You ever seen one of those ant farms they got in schools? All those hollowed-out chambers? That's a mine right there, in miniature. Nothing more than a big anthill with tunnels that lead to rooms. Only the rooms are called stopes, and they're carved out of rock instead of sand. Some are real small, only big enough for a man. Others are huge. In this particular mine, there's one room about 550 feet down that's nothing more than a big hollow ball of rotten rock with only these spindly pillar supports holding up the ceiling. There are stress fractures so wide in some of the walls you could drive a truck.
550 feet?
That was just about the height of the Washington Monument.
How deep does this mine go?
Just a little over 2,000 feet. Not that the little bastards can get that far down. Mine's been flooded below 1,000 feet for years. I wouldn't be surprised if the water's crept up even higher. In mines as old as this, you can have water on the level above or in the next chamber over and not know it, so long as the rock holds. People who go exploring in abandoned mines around these parts drown all the time.
So what exactly are you thinking about blowing up? The entrance? That room?
Not exactly. We want to take out the room underneath. It's not as big, but it's just as unstable. There's only 60 feet of rock between the two of them.
Meaning anyone planting bombs would have to drop down even deeper.
60 feet's still a lot of rock, Tom observed. Weller snorted.
In a mine like this, 60 feet is nothing. And like I said, the rock is rotten, like bad ice, all cracked and broken up with stress fractures.
Weller cupped air with his left hand.
So you got this great big room, and sitting right beneath it?
He slotted his right hand beneath the left.
You got this other smaller chamber. Both of them are under a tremendous amount of stress. So you make the bombs, you blow out the pillars in the room beneath this larger room,
and you knock out the legs. He now understood where this was going. Blow out the supports, and everything would come crashing down.
Exactly. You do it right, Weller said. We bury those sons of bitches.
It's a nice theory, Tom said, but there are a lot of variables, and you still need a high explosive, time fuses, igniters, blasting caps, not to mention a way in and out of the mine.
Melly stirred.
We've got that covered, Tom.
Really?
He squinted from her to Weller. If you guys are so covered, why haven't you blown the mine already?
Don't think we haven't considered it.
Leaning forward, Weller straight-armed his saddle's pommel, the aw-shucks cowpoke coming on strong.
But it's like this. You can give a little kid a broken-down pistol and bullets. If he's smart and given enough time, he might eventually put it together so it works. But the chances are also excellent that little tyke's gonna peek down the barrel and pull the damn trigger just to see what happens. Understand what I'm saying? We got components, we have all the fixings, but none of us is an expert. Takes a long time to learn how to build a bomb without blowing your head off. That's time we don't have.
We got components. Of course they would. There had to be lots of weapons lying around nowadays. Easy pickings if you knew what you were looking for, and Melly had said that they were covered. That meant they'd been amassing materiel and planning this for some time. He was their lucky accident, a piece of fortuitous serendipity. If he hadn't fallen into their laps, what then?
But what's the point? He asked. What will killing them accomplish? You said yourself they don't all stay there at one time. They move in and out.
Yeah, but it's efficient. More bang for the buck. Surely we won't kill all the little bastards. They're like rats. They've got to be hundreds out in these woods. But that mine is familiar territory and a meeting place. We chop off the head of this snake, and we accomplish two things.
Weller held up one gloved finger.
First off, we disorganize the little shits and kill a bunch of them in the process. A lot may scatter, and that's good. Second, and more important, this helps clear one path to rule. Not entirely, of course. Rule's got a pretty strong defensive perimeter set up.
So how does destroying the mine clear a path?
The old man cracked a nasty grin.
Because the Chuckies are part of the perimeter. Think about it. When you bait game, you can be pretty sure whatever you're drawing in will stick even closer. There's no incentive for that game to wander off. Now, who in their right mind is going to want to take on both the Chuckies and Rule's guns? See what I'm saying? It's like Rule's built up this guerrilla force, this buffer, which leaves them free to concentrate their firepower in other areas.
Weller let go of a disgusted grunt, but Tom thought he heard admiration there, too.
You got to admit, Peter and Chris had one hell of a brilliant idea there.
Brilliant, and pretty sick, too. Talk about lions at the gate. Even if this works, we won't just march into Rule. You said this kid Chris is pretty tough, right?
Oh, yeah. He's a sick son of a bitch. Real smart, real sneaky. There's almost no one there knows him well. You ask people, they'll tell you how wonderful he is. He's got them all brainwashed, but they haven't seen the stuff I have. That prison house is where he really cuts loose, no pun intended. You should have seen the last girl when he was done with her. I'm just glad the poor little thing didn't make it. Turn my stomach, and I saw a thing or two in Nam. I did Tet, us Rangers was at Dalat, and Phu Quang, and...
Yeah, yeah, and I've been at Masungar and Korangal and Paktika, so what? As much respect as he had for vets like Jed, he was getting a little tired of Weller always playing the Vietnam card.
This isn't a contest about which of us has seen worse, but you, of all people, ought to know that killing our way in
is the only way, Weller said.
His skin had gone chalk white with rage.
Or haven't you got the stomach for it, soldier?
You know that soldier jazz is getting really old really fast, he snapped. Don't bait me. All I'm saying is that you got out of Rule.
Weller stiffened.
I see where you're going, but getting out wasn't that easy. I had to arrange a search, then figure a bogus excuse for splitting off from the men who can't be trusted, and cover my tracks.
But you're not doing this out of the goodness of your heart. This is about some beef you've got with Rule.
What do you care what my reasons are? I'm offering you a way in.
But only if I do what you want, Tom countered. Regardless of whatever grudge you've got going, there has to be a way of getting to Alex that doesn't involve murdering innocent people.
Chuckies ain't people.
Tom shook his head.
I'm not talking about them. You're condemning an entire village, Weller. Not all the people there are guilty.
They're complicit in their silence, Melly put in.
The survivors who have bowed to Rule's conditions, who have decided upon survival at any cost, are as much to blame as the monsters on that council.
You think about girls and boys passed around. You think about Alex and some perverted, twisted old man old enough to be her grandfather taking her into his bed. Her words set his teeth. All I'm saying is that you need to think very, very hard about what you're asking. There's got to be another way.
There isn't, and we're wasting time,
Weller snapped. He gave his reins an angry twist. The blood bay let out a startled snort, then pranced and stamped as Weller brought the animal around.
From where I'm sitting, it's pretty damn simple, Tom. You're either in or you're out. You're for us or against us. So what's it gonna be?
And if I'm out? He doubted that Melly and Weller would simply let him refuse and go on his merry way. Refusing might even be a death sentence. Weller hadn't revealed everything, and Tom trusted neither him nor Melly. By his own admission, Weller was a traitor. Once you'd betrayed a friend, it was like a part of your soul crossed this invisible point of no return. Yet the math was clear. Alex was in trouble, and he needed a way into rule. These people were his best shot. Once he found Alex, they would both go somewhere far away where no one could touch them or hurt her ever again.
Tell me what to do, he said.
Chapter 65.
Good news, Peter croaked.
Those two words cost him. Breathing hurt, every swallow threatened to close his throat. Peter lifted his bruised hand to inspect the damage, finger-walking the margins of a flap of moist flesh and torn muscle beneath his left ear the size of a post-it note. Pretty bad. A little deeper, and Davy would have ripped his carotid in two, but the kid's impatience saved his life. Peter still felt the ghost of the kid's thumbs, which had jammed, dug down, and struggled to break his windpipe before Davy had given up and lashed out with his teeth. As soon as he felt the pressure let up and Davy's jaw battened down, Peter rammed the heel of his right hand into the kid's jaw. He would have finished the kid if the guards hadn't intervened. No doubt about it, though. Davy was getting stronger and smarter. Either that or he was getting weaker. Probably both.
Oh, yes.
Finn clipped his walkie-talkie back onto his hip and then reached into a deep pocket and withdrew a canteen.
I tell you, boyo, natural selection is a wonderful thing.
Yeah? The canteen was mesmerizing, a candle flame to a moth. Peter watched, transfixed, as the old man unscrewed the cap.
Mm-hmm.
Finn drank in big, languid swallows. The knuckle of Finn's Adam's apple rolled and bobbed and hitched. A trickle escaped to dribble onto the old man's chin, and Peter's tongue wormed to the corner of his own mouth in an effort to catch the drip. All he got was dirt and dried salt. His mouth tasted like an old toilet, and his breath reeked of rotted fruit. That wasn't good. He knew the stink of starvation. Today was Tuesday, almost 2.5 weeks since the ambush, and now 7 days in this cage. The last time he tasted water was 2 days ago. Since then, he'd had nothing to drink that wasn't his own piss. This morning, the half cup he'd squeezed out was dark as caramel, but he'd choked it down anyway. Last time he could pull that stunt, though. His pee was too concentrated now. Drinking any more would make his kidneys shut down just that much faster, which might be a relief, come to think of it. Slip off into a nice, quiet, lethal coma. Finn let out a satisfied sigh, just like a guy getting a taste of the day's first cold brew. He placed the open canteen on the grimy concrete, then reached into his pocket again. This time, he came out with a plastic bag.
Take our little experiment, Finn said, teasing open the plastic and releasing a bloom of peanuts, salt, chocolate, and sugary dried fruit. Our exploration of pressure, for example.
He wasn't sure which ache was worse, the desert dryness in his throat or the way his gut knifed.
Pressure? Well, isn't it?
Finn tossed back a handful of trail mix and munched.
Evolution is the study of environmental pressures. Either the individual adapts or he doesn't. Adaption is Mother Nature's idea of, Finn smiled, torture.
Yeah, you're really good with that. Water, Peter decided. The need for that was much worse. He watched Finn wash down his trail mix. If he'd had any tears left, he might have wept. Across the width of the cell block, he saw Davy in his usual spot, squatting at eye level and watching him with the same avidity. The kid was patient as a spider in a web, all glittery-eyed, just waiting for a nice, juicy fly to blunder by. The other changed also kept an eye on him, more or less. When he fought, that really seemed to grab them, but Davy was the only one who actually studied him. That morning, Davy had dragged on a pair of olive-green pants for the very first time, too. His chest was still bare, and he hadn't quite figured out shoes, but those pants were a step up. The only other kid anywhere close was a pimply boy who'd draped on a girl's bra so the cups covered his ears.
"I'm not trying to torture you," Finn inclined his head in Davy's general direction. "Or him, or the other Chuckies. I agree the metaphors are the same. But torture someone and all you get are lies, because everyone wants the pain to stop. What we are doing here is truth. We are studying how the Chuckies and normals adapt under selective pressure. Some Chuckies, like Davy here, will adapt better. Choking you was, well, a new skill. They can learn." Finn smiled. "Just like you."
This was true. Davy's method wasn't quite how Peter had killed Wendy, but close. After two rounds with the girl, he realized that she was a southpaw and always led with the left, so he'd waited, timed the blow just right, ducking and then pistoning out with his bald fist to fracture her windpipe. He could have ended it right there, a quick snap of the neck and it would be over. It was the way he'd dispatched a flabby kid with a bristle of broken braces the day before Wendy. But Finn hadn't liked that, hadn't told him why, but when Peter didn't get water that day, he realized that he either had to deliver a killing blow first time around or step back and let nature take its course. So he let Wendy suffocate, slowly, for 3 very long minutes. He didn't look away, either, because he worried that would cost him too. He got his water and a little food that day, but nothing since. This fight with Davy was the closest he'd come to actually losing.
"Why are you keeping me alive?"
he asked Finn.
"I'm not."
"Bullshit." Peter tried to laugh, but all he managed was a dry wheeze.
"The guards pulled Davy out before he could finish me. You won't kill me outright, but you make me fight for food and water. If I can't fight, I'll either die from thirst or because one of them finally kills me. So yeah, you're keeping me alive. Why?"
"Well, I'll tell you what, Peter."
Finn planted his hands on his thighs and pushed to his feet.
"Next time, don't fight."
"What?" Peter stared. "What are you talking about? How can I not fight?"
"Easily. You just don't."
But that was crazy. He had to fight, because that was his one shot at food and water. He might die, he might not. Don't fight, and he'd die for sure. A changed would have him for lunch, literally.
"If I don't fight, it's suicide," he said. "That's not an option."
"Well, if you want this to stop, it is," Finn said.
Kill himself?
The idea had never occurred to him. Anyway, letting a kid tear him to pieces wasn't suicide, was it? No, suicide was a bullet to the brain, a knife across his throat, a noose. Murder wasn't suicide.
"I can't just stop," he said.
"Yes," Finn said, "you could. It's a choice, right? Not fighting just happens to be a choice you don't like. You're very vince aut morire that way. Conquer or die."
"But I've always fought," Peter said.
And then he got it.
"That's what you want them to learn. How to fight until they win. How not to give up.
You want to see which ones can learn.
I knew you were a smart boy, Finn said, and turned to go. As he did, his boot collided with his canteen, which overturned, sending water sheeting over the filth. So you see, I'm not keeping you alive, Peter. You are. But Peter wasn't listening anymore. He was on his belly, lapping water like a dog.
Part 5. Kill All the Enemy. Chapter 66. 10 days ago, Tom had still been dubious about the whole plan. In part, this was because he didn't trust Weller or Melly as far as he could throw them. But he was also uneasy because of his reliance upon Weller's memories and assurances about the mine and its layout. By his own admission, the old man hadn't set foot below ground in the more than 30 years since the mine ceased operations.
There are things you just don't forget, though,
Weller had said, unfurling a grubby roll of yellowed paper over a low workbench that reminded Tom too much of Wade's butcher block. Considering that Melly and Weller's camp was situated on an abandoned farm whose hog barn had been converted into a command center, Tom thought this wasn't such a great omen. Weller's map was crap, just a rough pen-and-ink schematic with virtually no detail and nothing to scale. Yet the old man's description had been accurate. With its rough grid of vertical shafts and horizontal tunnels broken up by cartoonish balloons where the biggest chambers were located, the thing did remind Tom of a glorified ant farm.
"When it comes to hard rock mining, you basically got two options," Weller said. "You can either tunnel in from the side and then truck ore out on a decline ramp."
Tom shook his head. "I'm already lost. What's a decline ramp?"
"Just a big underground road. But you get to a point where you're down deep enough that using only the ramp becomes real expensive and inefficient."
Weller's finger jumped to a vertical line.
"So you drop a shaft, like what you see in the movies."
"And that's how they hauled up the iron ore?"
"Not iron," Weller said. "Gold."
"Gold?" Tom's eyebrows rose. "In Michigan? You're kidding."
"Nope," Weller said. "Rope's gold mine is the most famous. That's way, way east, near Marquette. We're in the second best place in the UP for gold, in Gojibik County. When the original Jaeger, this would have been the current Reverend's dad, started the first iron mine..."
"The one they eventually turned into Devil's Cauldron, right?"
"The lake, yeah. It's pretty common in these parts to fill tapped-out pit mines with water. Anyway, looking for gold was the brothers' idea, and once they did find it, they first tunneled into the mountain and then dropped shafts later. A shaft is a way of cutting down on distance. This ore body runs west to east, so it's better to drop a shaft over top and work your way down. Besides, once you're that far over, you need other escape routes in case something goes wrong, and in a mine, something always goes wrong. Plus, you situate the shaft right, you catch the air for better ventilation."
"With cross currents." He understood that. It was the same principle as opening multiple windows in a house, depending upon the prevailing winds. "So how many shafts? I see three here."
"The biggest ones, yep, going west to east."
Weller touched the vertical line left of center on the paper and closest to where he'd labeled the entrance to the mine.
"Shaft one, the Jaeger shaft, is the oldest and goes down to 850 feet. Further east, they drilled shaft two, which peters out at 1270.
Tom studied the name scribbled next to shaft two. "Ernst." That rang a bell. "Wait a minute. Isn't that the last name of that kid you told me about? The one who got killed in an ambush?"
"Peter."
Weller made a face like the name smelled bad.
"Yep, that's him. The Ernst partnered with the Jaegers from the get-go. Those families have always been tight."
Tom's eyes skated to the third shaft, which was both the deepest and the furthest east. "Who's Finn? Is he on this Council of Five you were talking about?" Tom thought he saw something spirit through Weller's eyes, but it might just have been a trick of the light.
"Nope," Weller said. Tell the truth, I don't know much about the Finns, other than they went in on the mine as partners, and then there was some kind of falling out. There is no Finn in rule now.
Okay, and you're sure these are the only shafts?
Nope, but they're the only ones that matter. I know there are others, but they're real straws by comparison. Probably one big enough around for a couple people to get in and out. I don't even know where they are, tell you the truth. Most will have caved in or filled up with water by now anyway.
What about the kids? Which shaft are they using to get in and out?
Near as we can figure it, they're not using any of the shafts. I think the Chuckies are holed up in the oldest chambers around the Jaeger shaft.
Weller traced the rough rectangles outlined in ink that lay less than a finger's width to the right of the Jaeger shaft.
Those are right off that underground road and the easiest to get to.
If this rock is as rotten as you say, why haven't these chambers come down already?
Oh, parts of this mine already have, way back in 1962, and pretty much around this same general area, only left of the shaft. You can't see it now because the Jaegers backfilled the thing, but the ground just collapsed. No warning, not even a rumble. The hole was 100 feet deep and 400 feet wide. Lost a couple trucks and one of the change-out buildings. Killed 7 miners,
Weller said, then added,
one of them was my dad.
Tom had a feeling there was a lot about Weller he just didn't know. What's keeping this one from caving in now?
Whether or not a mine caves in depends on how well you shore it up. You can backfill the space with sand, but it's expensive, and Jaeger Brothers was a cheap outfit. What they left behind instead were these real spindly rock pillars.
Weller skipped a finger to another rectangle penned immediately below the larger chambers.
The pillars in this one, where we'll plant the bombs, are even worse.
Like trying to hold up the second story of a rickety old house with toothpicks. How are we going to get underneath and into that room without being seen?
We get in and out through the Ernst shaft. You can't tell on this drawing, but the Ernst is actually a little southeast of the mine's main entrance. It connects up with the mine at regular intervals, starting at 670 feet. We climb down the shaft, then hike over and up, plant our bombs, and hustle back out the same way. It's about a half mile one way, so not bad. Might be a few stray Chuckies around, but we can handle them.
Weller shrugged.
All we need's a little luck.
I don't believe in luck. Luck was just a synonym for a random event that didn't kill you. Tom saw a dozen things that could go wrong. Designing the bombs to deliver maximum force where it was required would take doing. Without more sophisticated electronics, he'd have to figure out a way to time the explosions. Even if he managed to do that, the bombs might go off early or not at all. And what if the Chuckies posted guards, or they ran into more than a few? Weller had said that groups moved in and out of the mine. This particular kind of plan meant they could send out only a very small strike squad, 3 people at most, stumble on a crowd, and things would get interesting in a hurry. Or what if they succeeded but ended up trapped, or say they made it out of the mine only to die when the ground opened up under their feet? Knock out underground supports and the surface might cave in too, as Weller said had already happened back in 1962. Weller, even if we manage to collapse the room just beneath the kids, they'll still be above us, he said. What's to stop them from using Shaft 1 or working their way over to that big underground road to escape?
They can't. If you collapse the room, everything drops down. You knock out the guts of an apartment building, there's no way to get to the fire escape unless you climb up. Same thing here. The Chucky's only choice will be to go down, but there's no direct connection with the Jaeger shaft or the road at all. They'll be trapped good and tight. They won't be able to go down or up, and then those Chuckies either get crushed or suffocated or even drowned.
A nasty grin oiled over Weller's lips.
I don't care how they go, Tom. Just so long as that mine's gone, the way to rule is clear, and those monsters are dead.
Chapter 67.
10 days later, Tom planted his left pole in the snow and kicked off hard, skating on his right ski before shifting his weight to his left and driving forward. He had a rhythm down now, and Jed's old Timex told him that he was making excellent time. He'd passed their first lookout post, the bell tower of an abandoned Lutheran church, an hour ago. He was panting now, but the work felt good, his muscles limber and warm. The snow was perfect, 3 inches of fresh powder atop an icier, heavier 2-foot base like frothy whipped topping on ice cream. His destination was a different lookout post snuggled into the east rim of Devil's Cauldron. The lake was man-made, and all that was left of the first Jaeger Brothers mine. A rough, bowl-shaped gouge chunked from the earth that the Jaegers backfilled with water when the iron ore tapped out. The tailings, monstrous piles of rubble, had been covered with a thin layer of topsoil and were now home to snow-laden scrub and thin saplings on their way to becoming hardwood forest in another century or so. For now, the scrub offered good cover and an excellent view of the second mine to the west. The last quarter mile to the rim was all uphill, and he pushed himself, bounding up the slope, poling hard. By the top of the rise, Tom's heart was banging. His breaths came harsh and fast as he armed away sweat from his forehead, but he could feel how much stronger he'd gotten. A good thing, too. He would need every ounce of muscle he could muster, because in 3 hours, with any luck, they would be deep underground. As he slid to a stop, a muzzled dog slunk from a blind. A scruffy boy, all in winter white, followed a moment later. "Hey, Tom," the kid said. "Chad?" Tom unclipped from his skis, then ruffled the dog's ears. The kid had an Uzi carbine fitted with a suppressor, another of the toys Weller and Melly had in abundance. "Is Luke here?" "Yeah, he and Weller showed up 20 minutes ago." Chad lifted a chin toward Tom's pack. "Those them? Can I see one?" "Okay." Kneeling, Tom opened the pack and withdrew a steel cylinder the size of a soda can. 3 metal legs, secured with duct tape, protruded several inches from one end. "Whoa, that's pretty funky," Chad said. He ran a finger in a copper concave divot, capping one end of the cylinder. "So this is like Iraq and Afghanistan, right? An IED?" "On a smaller scale, yeah." Tom pointed to the divot. "That's your penetrator. Same principle as a bullet. Throw a bullet at a deer, it bounces off. But if you put a lot of force behind it, the slug punches through. A shaped charge channels energy. It's why bullets are so destructive. It's not the hole that kills you. It's the energy transfer to the rest of your body. Or in this case, the rock." It actually wasn't that simple, but Tom wasn't wild about giving any of the kids a crash course on explosives manufacturing. Bad enough that he was forced to take Luke, but working alone or with only Weller would take too long. Returning the charges to his pack, he cinched the drawstring, then stood and offered his hand. "Later, dude."
"Is it okay to wish you luck?" Chad asked.
In Afghanistan, guys had all kinds of superstitions, like never eating the charms from an MRE. M&Ms were okay, except the blue ones, but charms were the kiss of death. Charms they dropped in the burn shitter. Wish someone luck, you got your ass kicked.
"Oh, sure," Tom said.
The others waited on a small rise behind a screen of scrub. Luke heard him coming first and tipped a wave. Weller only nodded. Melly and the other lookout didn't turn around. Ducking behind brush, he squatted in the hollowed-out snow at Melly's shoulder.
"Anything new?"
Melly didn't look up from a pair of 26x70s mounted on a low tripod.
"I see some movement to the north, and there might be another group looping in from the west. Cindy?"
"Too far yet."
Peering through Big Eye's 40x100s, Cindy, a freckle-faced 12-year-old, nibbled her lower lip.
"But I think those guys dropping down the north approach road have prisoners."
Tom's stomach tightened.
"How can you tell?"
"The flashlights."
Luke was 14 and the oldest after Tom. He'd attached himself to Tom almost right away. Nearly all the kids had decided Tom was their big brother. He really didn't mind. All these kids made him feel a little better. He worried, too, what would happen to them when he and Alex left. Maybe take along the kids who wanted to come? Yeah, but could they really all manage? One step at a time, he thought. Do this, and then find Alex. The rest will sort itself out.
Luke sipped watered-down instant coffee from a mess cup.
We've been watching for a couple weeks. When there are flashlights, that usually means prisoners. The Chuckies don't seem to need a lot of light to see where they're going.
That was interesting. It might be another reason why the Chuckies favored the mine. Do you know how many? Tom asked.
Cindy did a one-shouldered shrug. 4, 5 in that group, maybe more. The Chuckies have really stocked up, though. There are a lot of people already in the mine for, you know.
A snack, Tom said. Innocent people they're putting by for a rainy day. Oh, Christ, Weller muttered.
Tom, Melly said.
Cindy's cheeks flushed a sudden furious scarlet. Her eyes pinged from Tom to Melly and back again.
Yeah, anyway, when this group gets a little closer, I can tell better.
Tom, we knew there would be prisoners, Melly said. Her tone sounded more like a warning. You're okay with this, right?
Which part? The killing innocent people part or the burying Chuckies alive part?
He knew it was the wrong thing to say, but he didn't want this to be easy either. This isn't a video game, Melly. Real people are going to die.
Well, isn't it good we got ourselves a group conscience, Weller growled. Tell me something, Tom. You get all soft and gooey on patrol?
I got my job done, Tom said.
Glad to hear it.
Weller unscrewed the thermos and splashed coffee into his cup.
I guess that explains why you're here instead of there.
He saw Luke and Cindy exchange startled glances, and a surge of anger brought the blood to his face.
Listen, Tom began.
Tom,
Melly pushed to her feet.
Let's walk.
Weller, why don't you come with us?
Weller's expression suggested he'd rather hug a cobra, but he recapped the thermos and followed.
Melly waited until they were behind a thicket of denuded scrub oak and a lonely jack pine. Then she crossed her arms over her chest.
Something on your mind, Tom?
You know what's bothering me, he said.
Yes, I do. So let me be clear. This is not a rescue mission. We need to make sure those monsters do not survive.
At the cost of innocent lives?
Don't tell me about innocent lives. You know Daniel and the rest of my kids never made it.
But that doesn't mean they're dead, Tom said. They might have gone their own way.
Unlikely.
Then has it occurred to you that they might be there in the mine?
Of course it has, but we've seen no children. Even if we had, that changes nothing. This has to be done.
I don't know what your problem is, Weller put in. You're not a cherry fresh out of basic. Collateral damage is part of the game.
It's not a game, Tom said. This is like storming a concentration camp. Weller snorted.
Jesus.
No, Weller, Melly said. He's got a point. But Tom, those people are dead men walking. If we succeed, some might live. Many won't, but we don't have a lot of choices. You're a soldier. Don't tell me you never fired on enemy targets when there were civilians around.
Not as a first choice, no. They were under orders, although his captain had changed his tune after an ambush killed his sergeant and wounded another.
Tom hadn't fired the javelin, that wasn't his job, but he saw the house cave in, and later, the 3 small bundles of bloodied sheets. The father was dead too, and so were 4 Taliban holed up inside. No one fired a shot from that house ever again.
Now, he said, it wasn't my call to make then, but this will be. We go through with this, it's on me.
This is a war,
Weller said, like that was supposed to be explanation enough.
Us against the Chuckies, us against rule. Taking out that mine is the first step.
Hard choices, collateral damage. Melly and Weller were very fond of catchphrases.
What about the people who have no say? The ones trapped in that mine who can't get out?
Weller cursed, then tossed the dregs of his coffee onto the snow.
I'm not debating this anymore. You're not in charge of this operation.
You're not my CO either, Tom said.
Well, lucky me, 'cause ain't he dead? In fact, it's a good bet your entire brigade's gone, isn't it?
The words dropped like hammer blows.
What does that have to do with anything? Because we're what's left. I was in Nam before your parents were in Diddy's. There's nothing about war I don't know. You want to see Alex again? This is how we do it.
Weller. Melly planted a palm on the old man's chest. We need to work together here.
Don't worry about me, Tom said, roughly.
Later, when he was alone, he'd probably put a fist through something, but right now there was Alex to think about.
I'll do my job. All right, then.
Weller's mouth worked as if he'd like to spit.
No harm, no foul.
Liar. But he kept his mouth shut. He'd taken his best shot. There was absolutely nothing he could say to this old man that wouldn't be a mistake right now.
Oh, Tom, Melly said.
She reached for him, but he sidestepped and left her grabbing air. Her sympathetic expression slipped, then firmed, but didn't quite leave.